Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance and Policy Committee. Today is March 9th, 2022. And first order of business is for Ms. Niedernhofer to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer, please. Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland. Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Ackland, present. Becker.
Becker, present.
Bonner. Bonner. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Brad, can you hear me okay?
Pryor.
Pryor, present.
Quam.
I'm
present.
Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. Next order of business is approval of the minutes of March 8th, 2022, yesterday. Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to approve the minutes from March 8th.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 8th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you. So the first bill on the agenda for today is House File 3717. Representative Stevenson is here with us. And since he's not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 3717, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And there are a number of amendments, but I think probably Representative Stevenson would probably want to present the bill and do that piece later.
That sounds good, Madam Chair.
All right. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 3717 reauthorizes the reinsurance program, which is designed to hold down premium increases in the individual and small group insurance markets by having government pay some of the costs of care that would otherwise be paid by the insurance companies. Reinsurance was created 5 years ago, and its proponents claimed it was a bridge program designed to help consumers until a more lasting solution could be found. 5 years later, proponents have not come up with a workable solution. DFLers have routinely supported allowing people to buy into the very popular, very effective, and very affordable Minnesota Care program, but Republicans have opposed that policy at every turn. With the original 5 years of the program having run out, we have a choice to make. Do we walk away from the reinsurance program and risk seeing insurance premiums suddenly increase? Under the American Rescue Plan, the federal government is paying for premium costs above 7% of income for all enrollees, which makes health insurance premiums far more affordable. But that protection is set to expire unless Republicans agree to extend it in the Biden Build Back Better plan. With inflation at a four-decade high, with COVID still a threat, and with extra premium subsidies set to expire, now is not the time to leave consumers without protection. Families are hurting, and we should do everything we can to keep them covered and protect them from sudden cost hikes. The bill reauthorized reinsurance, but also corrects some of the most substantial flaws in the original program. First, reinsurance hurts Minnesota Care. The federal government diverts funds that would otherwise be allocated to Minnesota Care to help private insurers keep premiums low. This bill makes sure that that practice ends and holds Minnesota Care harmless. Second, the bill has important measures to control out-of-pocket costs for consumers. Keeping down premiums isn't enough. Deductibles and copays are also hurting families. Last, because reinsurance was always planned to be a short-term solution and a bridge to something, we haven't yet, but there will be an amendment today to include a study looking forward to the next step after reinsurance, making sure that reinsurance is not a bridge to nowhere. And that Madam Chair, is a brief overview of the bill. I'm happy to address the amendments and take any questions committee members might have.
All right. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, Chair Stevenson. So are there any, maybe we should see if there are any brief questions to the bill itself before we go to the amendments. Okay, not seeing any. So the first amendment that I have is the A11 amendment. And for that one, I would go to Representative Morrison. I think she was going to offer that amendment. This is, I think, essentially an author's amendment. However, Representative Stevenson's not on the committee. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the A11 amendment recognizes the more recent understanding and acknowledgement of the fourth trimester, which is the period of time between birth and 12 weeks postpartum. This has increasingly been understood to be a particularly vulnerable period of time for both the mother or postpartum person and the infant. So this bill simply requires that three visits be allowed in that period of time. Traditionally, there has been only one or occasionally two visits in the event of a C-section. So this calls for three visits in that period of time and specifies the time periods when they might be. This is a recommendation of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice with an eye toward our increasing maternal mortality rates, the disparities between Black and American Indian women and their white counterparts, our mental health crisis, and our substance use disorder crisis. We need to make sure that our new mothers and their infants have access to the care that they need.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. And I should just note here for the record that there was an error in drafting. And so the amendment is actually drafted to the wrong version of the bill. And so if we adopt the amendment, I would be instructing the staff to make the necessary technical corrections to that amendment. Chair Stevenson, did you want to comment on the amendment?
Well, I thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for offering this amendment, which I think is very important. We want to make sure that the care that's being, or the insurance that's being provided, is of maximum value to consumers, and this seems important to that effort, so I'd ask members to support the amendment.
All right. Discussion to the amendment. All right. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of adoption of the A11 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And so, as I said before, the staff is instructed to please make the necessary technical corrections and provide them to the committee, LA. All right, next amendment is the A1 amendment. Representative Bierman. And you are muted.
Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair. So I'd like to thank Representative Stevenson for supporting copay reform in House File 3717 as the lead author on the copay language in question. I'd welcome the committee's support for the A16 or A1?
I have A1. Representative Bierman, hang on.
A16 was the amendment for this one, and A1 is my amendment. But that's a different bill.
Oh, well, let me see.
Madam Chair, I believe it is the A16.
It's the A16, yes.
Correct. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman.
I do welcome the committee's support for the A16. It makes three constructive updates to the copay language that this committee supported last session. Lines 1.2 and 1.3 clarify our intent that the copay benefit should not require insurers to offer platinum plans unless other changes in law require them to offer platinum plans. Lines 1.5 to 1.8 seek to clarify that copay benefits should not interfere with the normal payment structures in place between insurers and pharmacies. And lastly, line 10 sets the implementation date to January 2024 to give ensures proper time to implement the copay benefit. None of this will interfere with the Commerce Department's favorable findings on the copay proposal, and I urge members to support the A16 amendment, please, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Is there any discussion to the A16 amendment? All right, not seeing any. So all in favor of the A16 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
No.
The motion prevails and the A16 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Bierman. And then we have the A15 amendment, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I will move the A15 amendment. And what this amendment does, members, is it puts on study language that we had passed last year in our omnibus bill, delivery reform analysis report done by the agency, and a proposal to study a public option idea. And these reports would be done in a timely process, and given the results would be given to the legislature to review the results.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Is there any discussion to the A15 amendment? Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would just say this is, this bill is becoming a Christmas tree of bad healthcare legislation, and this is just another step in the wrong direction. So I would encourage members to oppose this amendment because it's going to do more damage to the healthcare system than help.
More discussion to the amendment. Okay, and I guess I would just say, Representative Grunhagen and others, that I guess one person's Christmas tree is another person's Christmas. This bill that's before us, reinsurance, is one that I and a lot of DFL members have opposed for years. And I think that Representative Stevenson stated it very well. It's supposed to be a bridge, and it's become a bridge to nowhere. And what Representative Schultz is offering here is to study something that could be a landing place at the other end of the bridge. Unless Republicans think that we're just going to keep pouring public money into private insurance to make it less expensive and do that ad infinitum, I don't know what other choice we have here. So you may not like the study because you think of what it's, I frankly don't really see what's the problem with studying something to give us a possibility of going somewhere later on and knowing what we're doing. That seems to me to be a pretty mild thing to be doing at a time when we're moving forward a bill that is, after all, something that Republicans want and DFLers tend not to really be in love with. So, Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, you could pass my reference-based healthcare plan, which eliminates networks and pre-certifications that would lower premiums dramatically and deductibles. But you don't seem to have any appetite to keep the private health insurance market in force, unfortunately.
All right, is there any other discussion?
Yes, Chair Liebling.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and Representative Grunhagen. That could be part of this delivery reform study, some of your ideas. So you should definitely support this amendment. But also, I have another bill for you to look at, health affordability, that will be out next week. So we should chat, Representative Grunhagen. But this, we do have to build a bridge to somewhere because the Senate heard the reinsurance bill today and put a $1 billion subsidies to the health plans over 5 years. That is a lot of money. We just cannot continue reinsurance. I think we need to build something else to control our healthcare cost growth. And I think everyone should support that. We have to evaluate what we're spending on healthcare because it's simply going to be unaffordable for so many families in Minnesota.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the part of what you said, Representative Schultz, I agree with. And I know you want what's best, okay? It's just we disagree. But what we're doing here is we're building a bridge to socialism with your with this A15 and a lot of the provisions in this plan. And socialism doesn't work. You don't need a study, okay? All over the world, it's been a failure. Otherwise, move to Venezuela, get your health care there, go to Cuba, you know, go to these countries that believe in socialism and see how you like it. Thank you.
Well, you know what I would just say about that? I don't know what Representative Schultz would say to that, but I would just say that I don't think helping people have health care that's affordable to them, you can call it whatever you want. You know, you can call it green cheese. But if it gives people, the people of Minnesota, the opportunity to have health care when they need it without going bankrupt, I'm all for it. So, you know, the name calling doesn't do anything. I think Minnesotans are smarter than that. And I think it's enough, Representative Grünhagen. I think we're going to go to a vote on the bill now, or on the amendment at least. So the A15 is before us. All those in favor of the A15, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails aye. And the amendment is adopted. All right, back to the bill as amended. Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Grünhagen, you want a discussion of the bill or are you just leaving your hand up?
Let's think once. I'm trying to think what I can say that you won't rule me out of order, okay? Just kidding. No. Yeah, I guess I do have a question for Representative Stevenson, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Grünhagen.
Hey, Representative Stevenson, we know that a lot of the provisions in here are not going to be very acceptable to the Senate, if any. Are you really trying to pass, you know, for a little while, you almost sounded like a Republican in your comments. You know, are you really looking to try to do something with reinsurance? I see you're one, you know, according to the information I have, you want to extend it to 2027. And yet you wouldn't vote to extend it even 1 year last year. So if you just want to do some clarification on what you hope to do with this bill.
Representative Stevenson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Grünhagen, I want to pass the bill. That's why I authored the bill. That's why I'm bringing it to committee. I'm very puzzled by your comments. On the one hand, you say that I sounded like a Republican, and then you say that you don't think the Republican Senate would take any of the language in the bill. I don't really know. You're kind of coming at me from every direction here. But what I'd say is this bill extends a program that's necessary right now. I didn't, you know, on the floor last year, we didn't include reinsurance in our budget because the federal subsidies made reinsurance redundant, and it was maybe not the best use of state resources. That was the argument. As I said clearly in my remarks, those subsidies are set to expire because Republicans in Congress are blocking their extension, and we need to protect Minnesotans from premium increases in the short run while coming up with a plan for the long term. So if your question is, what do I intend to do with this bill? I intend to pass it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grünhagen.
I guess, you know, the thing is, I agree it's a Band-Aid, okay? I agree that reinsurance is a Band-Aid. We don't want to do it long term. But that's why we need to pass real health care reform that frees up people to go to the doctor their choice, gets rid of networks and pre-certification. When I started selling health insurance in 1978, there were no networks and no pre-certification. And in fact, when they were introduced in the 80s, I said in a meeting with about 40 insurance agents, I said, this is a noose. Once we got our neck in there, it's going to tighten. And I was kind of poo-hooed and laughed at. That's exactly what's been going on. And you pass this bill with all this stuff on it, and you're going to have less access and more people struggling for health care, and it's going to turn into a second-rate health care access plan rationed by the government. Thank you.
All right, so I almost forgot that we do have two testifiers here today because we've been over this ground so many times, but We have Bentley Graves. Mr. Graves, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent more than 6,000 employers across the state in every industry of the state, every corner of the state, all sides of business. And we work on healthcare issues, as I think many of you know, because it's incredibly important benefit for our members, to offer their employees, both in terms of keeping their employees healthy and productive at work, but also as an increasingly important tool in this tight labor market to retain and attract talent. But as you also know, that's becoming more and more of a challenge with rising healthcare costs. Now, some have wondered over time, you know, what interest the business community has in a stability mechanism like reinsurance for the individual market, given that most employers buy coverage for their employees in the group market. But the individual market, first and foremost, is an important outlet for self-employed individuals and entrepreneurs to gain coverage for themselves and their families. But increasingly, it's also becoming an important outlet for small and mid-sized employers. And this is especially true in the last couple of years, as recent allowances have been made by the federal government permitting employers to help their employees buy insurance in the individual market through sort of defined contribution arrangements. And just to kind of underscore this point, in a survey of our members just this summer, 6% of our members are already providing coverage to their employees through these defined contribution arrangements. 1 in 10 of our members who offer coverage have noted that if healthcare costs continue to rise at the pace that they're currently increasing, they're going to be turning to options like these defined contribution arrangements to provide coverage to their employees. And nearly 30% of our members who currently aren't able to offer coverage to their employees in the group market or otherwise noted that they are actively looking at these options for themselves and their employees. And now, again, these may seem like insignificant numbers at first glance, but again, I would reiterate the fact that these options have only been available since 2020. And so I think it certainly undermines or underscores the emerging trends that we believe provide all the more reason to maintain a healthy and stable individual market here in Minnesota. And frankly, reinsurance has done just that. It's brought stability to the market. It's lowered rates anywhere from 20% to more than 30%, depending upon the metal level of the product you choose. And we know that rates would increase significantly without in place in 2023 and beyond. So we certainly encourage the continuation of reinsurance in Minnesota, and thank Representative Stevenson for bringing the legislation to do so forward. And before closing, Madam Chair, I would just note on the conversation that was just had, you know, we would note the statements from the Commerce Department that have underscored the urgency and the timeliness of passing legislation to reauthorize reinsurance here in Minnesota. And we would encourage a process, frankly, to do that and do it in a timely manner, without, you know, extraneous provisions added to the bill that may slow its progress through the legislative process and its ultimate passage. But nevertheless, we want to add our support to extending reinsurance in Minnesota. And again, I want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this legislation forward. And with that, Madam Chair, be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Graves. I'm going to ask you something real quick before I go to Representative Munson. I don't know if his question is for you or not, but if you're still there. So, first of all, does the chamber also represent the health plans, or are they totally separate?
Madam Chair, within our membership, we do have health industry members, from providers to payers across the spectrum. But again, the vast majority of our members are small, mid-sized employers with 80 employees or less.
Yeah, no, I understand. But the people who are the entities that make up the Council of Health Plans, are they also members of the chamber?
Some of them are, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. We have health plans as members. Yes.
Okay, just so we understand whose interests are speaking to us. And then, okay, I think that's it. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You actually asked my question for me, so that's what I had. So thank you. I'll pass.
All right. Thank you very much. And the other thing I would just say in answer to your comment, Mr. Graves, is that you know, if you want us to take off all what you call the extraneous stuff, that for us is the Christmas. So, you know, I frankly, personally, don't want to pass this bill. So if you think that the House is going to pass it, I think, you know, you should possibly get behind some of the other measures that are traveling with it. Mr. Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Dan N. Greason with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the trade association representing Minnesota's nonprofit health plans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of extending the state's reinsurance program, which has stabilized the market and lowered premiums for people buying insurance on their own in the individual market. It does so by paying a portion of high-cost medical bills, a cost that otherwise must be billed in premiums. If you're a Minnesotan living with cancer, reinsurance funds are paying for a part of your tests and drug bills. If you're a Minnesotan with diabetes, reinsurance is paying for a part of your insulin bills. And if you're a Minnesotan living with a heart condition, reinsurance is paying for a part of your medical bills. And if you're a provider treating someone who's living with one of these conditions or another condition, reinsurance funds are being used to pay you to provide this care. Under Minnesota's reinsurance program, high-cost claims paid by health plans are partially reimbursed with reinsurance funds, which are audited by the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. Doing so effectively takes a portion of these costs out of the premium equation and lowers annual premiums for everyone in the individual market. The association ensures program integrity by contracting with an independent actuarial firm and makes public on their website the quarterly and annual reports examining the program's operations. In your packets is the most recent 2021 fourth quarter report, which documents where funds are allocated by health plan, geographic area, metal level, and health condition. The reinsurance program has performed as advertised. The individual market has been stable and has lowered premiums by an average of 20% compared to what premiums would be without the program in place. Conversely, if reinsurance is not extended, these costs could be built back in, causing an additional premium increase of 15 to 25%. A recent analysis of the program by CMS found that impacts could be much greater, possibly up to 36% for some products. This could result in 15,000 Minnesotans without coverage in 2023. Reinsurance is a proven program and has been so successful, 14 other states have enacted programs over the last several years, and Congresswoman Angie Craig is one of the leading advocates for creating a federal reinsurance program. The council thanks Chair Stevenson for his leadership to continue Minnesota's reinsurance program, and we urge your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Okay, so I think we are ready to vote on the bill. I think we're fully informed. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure we had enough time for our testifiers to get through. I just wanted to kind of, I'll try to be brief here, but, you know, I really struggle with this bill. You know, we are continuing to put more money into private insurance plans who, you know, we're trying to cover their losses, but quite frankly, some of the losses we experience here are because we have plans that aren't doing good preventative care. They're locking people out of preventative care, which drives up costs down the road. And I really struggle with, rather than being more efficient and finding ways to cut costs so we don't have to be covering that nut, that just doesn't seem like a good use of taxpayer dollars to encourage folks not to become more innovative and work towards good or better outcomes for patients. So I struggle with that. But I also appreciate that we are in an unenviable position where if we don't act, and we must act, that it could spell a really difficult time for family budgets. So, you know, I just want to say I will be supporting this bill today because it's a necessary step for our families. But I do agree that I am delighted that we added the study from Representative Schultz onto this bill, because we have to come up with better long-term solutions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. Grunhagen and then Munson. Representative Grunhagen.
Real quick. Just remember the promises of Obamacare, okay? And how many of them turned out to be lies? I would ask members to think about that. It turned out to be an abomination. All it did was bloat the bureaucracy and did nothing for the doctor-patient relationship. And it had all these promises of how people were going to be covered. And because it was based on socialism, it turned out to be a lie and made things worse. And that's what this is going to do. Not the reinsurance, but the rest of the junk on there.
All right. Well, Representative Grunhagen, as Representative Moran quite rightly said, your speech has not changed in all these years. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question for the bill author. It's my understanding that we're taking tax dollars from all Minnesotans and paying down the rates for some like 3 or 4% of Minnesotans in the private market. I've explained the reinsurance program to people because it, on its face value, it sounds good. It lowers the premiums, but it does nothing to lower the cost of the underlying care. It doesn't do anything to lower the prices of care. It just is a cost shift in basically socializing the premiums for a very, very small percentage of the market. Am I wrong in this, or what is the percentage of people in the private market that this is lowering the cost for? And is it taking the tax dollars from everyone?
Representative Stevenson, or I think we also have Mr. Brickwitty here, if you would rather punt to him, but go ahead.
No, I thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson for the question. I don't have the specific percentage, and maybe we can ask Mr. Brickwitty for the specific percentage that are in the individual and small group market, but you are correct that the basic functioning of reinsurance does not decrease the actual cost of care. It's a way of adjusting the cost. And like you, I did notice the irony in Representative Grunhagen criticizing the socialism of Obamacare while praising reinsurance, because it is ultimately a redistribution of cost. And one that, you know, I have supported in the past and am asking the committee to support. The other thing I did want to point out, and I probably should have said this in my opening remarks, but we are not putting any, in this bill, we do not put any more money into reinsurance. There is no general fund appropriation or any appropriation to the reinsurance program. It simply reauthorizes the program, which is a step we need to take in order to get the waiver extended. It would be wonderful, in my view, if we could pass Representative Schultz's House File 11 before the end of session and not have to put any money into reinsurance at all. And perhaps, Representative Munson, you'll join me in that effort. I would really appreciate your support to that. But to answer your specific question of what percentage is in that market, I think Mr. Brickwitty might have the answer.
Mr. Brickwitty?
Madam Chair, for the record, Assistant Commissioner Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. I think we're at about 4% of the coverage spectrum, Representative Munson, in the state's individual market. I think at last count, between 160 and 170,000 Minnesotans. I would add that the stability of that market does provide stability across the entire fully insured market beyond. Beyond just in the individual market, because when we have instability there, there's movement within the coverage spectrum. But specifically, the program reimburses health insurers for claims in the individual market. I would add just one on, in addition to Chair Stevenson's points, I would also add that Minnesota has long subsidized the individual market, even before the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. We long subsidized it through MSHA's original purpose as the state's high-risk pool. That was a subsidy mechanism for the entire operational period of time that program existed, and provided coverage to individuals who had pre-existing conditions, who were denied coverage in the individual market, and were segregated into a separate risk pool where they were charged higher premiums at up to 125% of the average premium in the market. And so your point is well taken, Representative. This has been a market that the state has chosen to subsidize in different ways for decades.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Representative Munson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to have just a follow-up comment. And so my numbers were right. It was, 4% of the market, and reinsurance doesn't do anything to lower the cost. It's just a shifting. I supported MSHA and the concept of it because it was paid for by plans that were participating in the private market in proportion to their market share. But this market is anybody that wants to buy private insurance, and we're not doing anything to lower the cost of care. I don't support reinsurance because it's just shifting. It's just socialism and healthcare. It's taking a large chunk of the cost of the insurance company, and their whole role as insurance companies to offset their risk. They're just offsetting it onto the taxpayers. And so for that reason, I'm going to be voting against it. I hope we can solve this problem with price transparency and letting people shop for care. But this isn't the solution, and certainly not the solution long term. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Munson. And you and I are really thinking a lot alike today, because I was also going to note that what Mr. Brickwitty left out was that the plans were paying. Now, of course, the state was also subsidizing, because the fees that were collected from the plans, I think, was often or maybe always not enough. But the plans were paying in the old MCHA. Representative Quam, and then hopefully we'll get to vote on the bill. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not saying it raining cats and dogs, so that you agreeing with Representative Munson and some of the discussion is just because this is a very difficult topic. We've talked about trying, you know, that this doesn't solve any of the problems. I hope that at some time we can look at things that would save, and there are studies out that have indicated other states have tried and other places have tried different things, and maybe sometime we can have a hearing to look at some of those cutting edge approaches to saving. Right now we're in the unenviable task of, we don't have agreed upon a solution, and we are maintaining status quo with a bill that has things added in to make some people feel better, and we'll see what the end result is. But we have not had free market medical for a long time. There have been cost shifting from, you know, government programs that pay less than the cost to other programs. Perfection we don't have, we're not going to receive, but I think the choice we have is, are we going to allow the current system that we are operating with to collapse, or are we going to do something in a timely manner that would allow for kicking the can just a little bit down the road? And I like a lot of the intent. I just wish we would be a little bit more straightforward in actually what this process is. So I will hold my nose and wait for the vote.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Final word, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for the discussion. I'll just say very briefly that there's been a lot of conversation today that has unusual bedfellows, but I appreciate that very much. I do want to briefly just comment on the criticism of the Affordable Care Act that's been made here by noting that, according to the statistics I pulled this morning, 335,700 and some odd people have health insurance in Minnesota today because of the Affordable Care Act. It cut the uninsured rate in Minnesota in half. It's incredibly popular, which is probably why Republicans were unable to repeal the program even when they had complete control of government. And so having set the record straight on that, I'd ask for a yes vote.
All right, thank you, Representative Stevenson. So House File 3717, the first engrossment as amended, is before us, and so Ms. Niedernhofer will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Liebling aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher no.
Schumacher no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland no.
Ackland no. Representative Backer.
Backer no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Damuth, no.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel. Representative Keel. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yet.
Quam, aye. Representative.
I think that was a no, Ms. Niederhofer. I'm translating from the Russian. Right. It was no.
No.
Something.
Representative Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. And now go back to Representative Keel. Okay, there are 11 ayes and 7 nays.
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is passed, or it is House File 3717, the first engrossment as amended, is re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson. Okay, we will go on now to House File 3786, and this is Representative Bierman's bill. And Representative Bierman is going to move that House File 3786 be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee finance bill. So there is now an A1 amendment, and Representative Bierman, did you want to take care of that right now to get it in the right form?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to take care of the A1 now, if we could, please.
All right.
So I'd like to move the A1, please.
All right. Representative Bierman moves the A1 author's amendment.
And if you want a description, it's based on DHS suggestions for more specificity and clarity, and appreciate the help of the department, and we'll work more with them as the bill progresses.
All right, thank you. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Once again, maybe I should ask again, everyone, please unmute yourselves. All in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Okay, any opposed? All right, thank you. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I thought it was just going to be two of us. I was going to have to vote as well, so thank you. All right, so the bill is before us, and we also have Representative Baker here to help present, and I will turn the floor over to you, Representative Bierman, and to Representative Baker as you choose.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I would like to present today. Just want to start with, 2015 letter, the American Cancer Society warned the CDC that their guidelines seeking to reduce inappropriate opioid prescribing had the potential to significantly limit cancer patient access to needed pain medications. Quote, "Our concerns are so serious we cannot endorse the proposed guidelines in any way." Nevertheless, the CDC guidelines were approved and have been interpreted and essentially implemented as strict policy in more than 30 states, Minnesota included. In a 2021 letter, the American Medical Association stated, "The 2016 guidelines have been devastating for patients with pain and urged the removal of arbitrary thresholds," adding as well, "The CDC's threshold recommendations continue to be used against patients with pain to deny care. We know that this has harmed patients with cancer, sickle cell disease, and those in hospice. The restrictive policies also fail patients who are stable on long-term opioid therapy." Members, other states have already taken action to address the situation. Oklahoma, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and most recently Arizona, acted to improve access to care for chronic and intractable pain patients. House File 3786 will take action in Minnesota to permit doctors to deliver the patient-centered care chronic and intractable pain patients require. Madam Chair, I do want to invite my colleague and co-author, Rep. Baker, at this time to say a few words regarding this legislation.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker.
Good to be back, Madam Chair. It's for briefly here, and I just want to thank Representative Bierman and for the members. And again, for those of you that weren't around, I'm just going to take a minute to just say how hard I've worked on opioid legislation that makes sense. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, when this was a completely different problem than what we're seeing today with overprescribing and policies that were not really in line with what was best in the patient's outcome long term, we still were missing, though, some of the patients that had been very stable with opioids. No one has ever said from day one, opioids should not be part of medicine. And there's been a lot of other things that we can do to help people with their pain. And we've learned, obviously, pain is extremely complex. So Representative Bierman's bill attempts to try to make sure that we take some pressure off of doctors, and we're not going to solely focus on the morphine milligram equivalents. And that's a big, important thing that we need to do quickly this session to make sure the doctors, the providers, the dentists, if they're prescribing, they need to be told that they're doing a much better job than they ever have been before. But also, we can't let them be fearful and leaving their patients for faster tapers or flipping them over to a new doctor or pain clinic. These patients deserve to have some time with their current providers so that they can ease off this thing. So, and again, some are very, very patient and very stable with their current prescribing. So solely on the MMEs is not how to prescribe. We need to kind of back off a little bit. And again, I just want to say I appreciate the work that Representative Bierman has done. I look forward to hearing the testifiers as well. And this bill needs more work. It needs to, it's a complicated issue, but we need to do something this year. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to this, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Thank you for being here. So we have a number of testifiers, and the first one on the list that I have is Dr. Beth Darnall. Dr. Darnall, are you here? Welcome.
I am. Greetings, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm delighted to present to you today. I am going to share my screen.
And if you could just state your name for the record and your where you're from.
Yes.
I am
Dr. Beth Darnall. I'm an associate professor at Stanford University. I'm the director of the Stanford Pain Relief Innovations Lab. I have twice testified to the U.S. Congress on the pain and opioid crises. I have provided invited testimony to the FDA on iatrogenic harms caused by opioid tapering. And in 2020 and 2021, I served on the CDC opioid work group that advised the CDC on needed changes to their guideline. Today, I'm going to briefly present to you on protecting patients with chronic pain and some adaptations that are needed. I just want to make sure I'm in the right present. Am I in presenter view? Oh, here
no.
We go. Yeah, there we go. Okay, terrific.
Oh, good. Now.
Okay, perfect. So my research on prescription opioid tapering is funded by the NIH and by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. I'm going to be presenting on that today. I think you're all aware of the scope and magnitude of the problem of chronic pain in the United States. Up to 1 in 3 adults is living with chronic pain of some type. It confers tremendous suffering. In terms of an economic consequence, it is of greater magnitude than diabetes, cancer, and heart disease combined. Now, Representative Baker had mentioned that there was in the past some prolific opioid prescribing to the tune that in 2015, we had almost 3.5% of U.S. adults were taking daily prescription opioids. This is about 11 million individuals. Now, in 2016, the CDC put forward the guideline for prescribing opioids in the United States, and the consequence of that publication was that there was a precipitous drop in opioid prescribing, and this wasn't just in terms of new starts, it was in terms of reducing opioids in patients who had been stable and taking them long term. Now, this is problematic because when patients have been taking daily prescription opioids for months, years, and for some patients, even decades, these are patients with complex medical comorbidities, we see that there are neuroadaptations that occur to create different changes changes in the central nervous system, when changes to the medication doses occur, this can create a destabilization in some patients with very grave harms, iatrogenic harms. And this is what we had been seeing from the 2016 publication until present time, where we saw study after study that was describing these iatrogenic harms, these harms actually caused by the medical intervention itself of opioid reduction. We see that it's not so much whether you're increasing opioids or decreasing opioids. It's that when changes to medications occur in the consequence of prescription opioids, that these health risks are imposed. All of these new studies showing that in an effort to theoretically keep patients safe by reducing their dose, we were creating new risks for them. These were risks for opioid overdose, for suicidal ideation, for mental health crises, and for patient suicide. A tragic, tragic consequence in the theoretical effort to keep our patients safe. So what occurred over the course of a short time span was that multiple advocacy groups began writing in to the CDC, to the FDA, calling for an end to the misapplication of the 2016 CDC guideline and really calling for patient protections. These are vulnerable patients, often with the least means, managing medical comorbidities, who were being put at risk. I was honored in 2019 to be invited to weigh in on the 2019 CDC opioid tapering guidance, which called for patient-centered practices to be applied. Most recently, in the fall of 2021, we saw this seminal study published in JAMA, in which tapering was associated with mental health crises and overdose in patients prescribed high-dose opioids. So again, these patients taking daily prescription opioids need careful protections to ensure that we are actually helping them and improving their health and not unwittingly harming them based on a flawed policy. So what have we been getting wrong? We've had a lack of patient-centered care nationally. We have failed to collect patient-reported data that ensures that we're keeping our patients safe. We have seen a one-size-fits-all approach applied that does not account for the individual variability that exists in each individual patient. We have seen that there is a lack of access to comprehensive pain care and a failure to implement flexible pain care that acknowledges and honors the doctor-patient relationship. We cannot have medicine legislated. We cannot have policies that treat each person as if they fit neatly into a box, because they don't. What we see is that when tapering is applied in the wrong way, there is a whole host of negative consequences that can occur, such as withdrawal symptoms, discomfort, distress, remaining on high doses that may be inappropriate for a person, suicidal ideation, and even suicide. So we see this occur in the context of forced tapering and also aggressive taperings that are occurring too rapidly. So what's needed? We need to treat the person and not the pill. And this is where we really need these flexible patient-centered policies that Representative Bierman is both championing and referencing in this presentation. So my team, we've been studying this now for 6 or 7 years. We published the first report of patient-centered prescription opioid tapering and community-based outpatients with chronic pain. This was conducted in Colorado clinics in 2015 through 2017. We invited everyone in a practice who was taking daily prescription opioids to partner with us in a patient-centered opioid reduction program, in which they would have a lot of control over the pace of their taper, whether they wanted to stop their taper or not. We would focus on that person, their symptoms, and ensure that each step of the program was attending to their needs. We did not talk about opioid cessation. And what we focused on was helping each person reduce their opioids to their comfortable dose over the course of 4 months. So again, focusing on the person and their response. What was unusual about our study was that participation was voluntary. Patients could control the pace of their taper, they could pause the taper, they could stop the taper, they could drop out if they wanted to. And if circumstances occurred in a person's life where they needed to actually increase their opioid dose, we allowed that so long as the prescribing clinician determined that that was the appropriate course of medical action for that person. So I'm going to present to you the results of this patient-centered opioid taper. Now, 68 patients enrolled in our program and 51 completed the four-month program. Only one factor predicted whether someone dropped out of our study or not, and those were patients with higher levels of depressive symptoms. So the data that I'm going to present to you right now do not generalize to patients with high levels of depressive symptoms. So please keep that in mind. These are the sample characteristics. You'll see that if you go to the last bullet, people were taking roughly 300 morphine equivalent daily doses. In today's climate, this is considered high dose. At the end of our patient-centered program, 4 months later, we found that patients who worked with us were able to successfully reduce their opioid doses about in half over the four-month period. And we collected all of these patient data to ensure that nobody was deteriorating across a range of symptoms. And we showed that everyone was remaining stable. Now, opioid doses aren't the point. That is what I'm basically saying to all of you today. What happened to people's pain while they were reducing their opioid dose? And what this data slide shows you, each dot is an individual person. As people were substantially reducing their opioid doses, on average, pain did not increase. So what that means is we have a successful formula working with patients in a voluntary manner to help them reduce their doses without increasing their pain. But here's where I really want to focus your attention. Look at the individual patients within those circles. These are patients who followed our methods, but they did have increased pain and or they increased their opioid dose. This is what we call the outliers. And this is the reason we need patient-centered policies to reflect the reality that one size does not fit all, even when you're applying the best methods. We followed people up to 3 years later, and we found that on average, people were continuing to reduce their opioid doses without having increased pain. But again, I highlight these individuals for whom that was not the case, and these patients are the ones that need protections within the context of our policies. In 2019, Health and Human Services published the opioid tapering guidance, and this is the document that I served as a reviewer on, and you will see our methods baked into this guidance. So for the past 4 years, we have been conducting a very large national trial on patient-centered opioid tapering. This is funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, and we are applying these same methods that I just described to you in our prequel study that was conducted in Colorado. This is voluntary tapering. Each patient partners with their clinician to gently reduce their dose over a 12-month period. So we're following people for an extended period of time, and this follows the recommendations by other researchers who have determined that we are not following patients closely enough or for a long enough duration of time. In addition to following this patient-centered opioid tapering program, we're also layering in behavioral medicine strategies. This allows for whole person pain care within the context of tapering. These are the study sites. We are active in 5 states. We are studying 1,400 patients in total, and we are training physicians on how to implement these patient-centered practices. What we need, though, are the policies that allow for this and support this, and this is where Minnesota is so important. We must create a caring and safe system that makes patients want to join and remain in Empower, because remember, this is a voluntary study. We follow patients very closely. We have e-safety nets where patients complete surveys on a weekly basis, also on a monthly basis. They tell us in their own words how they're feeling, how they're doing, when they need more support, and we are able to respond to them in real time to assure their safety. This prevents some of those horrible iatrogenic consequences where we've seen suicidality, suicide, and other problems. And we can prevent that because we're monitoring so closely. Patients tell us that they're receiving better care in our program than they would otherwise, because no physician has the ability to track on people in real time when they need it. But our systems allow for this. So I just want to close out by saying in 2019, Health and Human Services called for patient-centered voluntary tapering practices as a priority. HHS also called for patient support to occur during the tapering process. And multiple groups have called for close and extended patient monitoring, home-based e-surveys, so that we can assure our patients are staying safe. So what we can do for the state of Minnesota, we offer Minnesota all of our established systems at no cost. We can supply to you all of these methods that can help patients who want to reduce their opioids do it in the right way and stay safe. This provides clinician support too. And we can also supply at no cost efficient, scalable behavioral supports as well. So with that, I just want to say opioid tapering is not right for all patients, but when it is applied in the right patients, we need patient-centered methods that account for the variability in each person, attends to their needs, and puts their safety as the priority. This can all be supported with Minnesota supporting Representative Bierman and his efforts in this regard. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Darnell, I'm sorry. Very good. Okay. And I see that we have one hand up. My intention, though, would be to let to go through all of the testifiers and before we take questions, unless there's something that we need right now. Representative Grunhagen, did you have something that you need clarified?
Oh, that's fine. Go ahead and go through the testifiers.
Okay, thank you. You'll be first on the list when we get done. Okay, next we have Dr. David Schultz.
Welcome. And I am here. I'm going to turn on my video here. Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today on House File 3786. My name is David Schultz, MD, and I'm here representing MSIP, the Minnesota Society of Interventional Pain Physicians. And I've been a practicing board-certified pain specialist in the Twin Cities for the past 30 years. I am testifying in support of this critical legislation. First of all, I understand the perplexing intersection of two public health challenges. One, promoting effective and safe chronic pain management, while at the same time preventing the abuse and diversion of opiate medications. And I've been a vocal advocate for safe opiate prescribing in Minnesota for the past 20 years. In fact, my MSIP colleagues and I testified before the Minnesota legislature in 2006 and 2007 to gain support for the Minnesota PMP legislation. And at the time, this opioid tracking database was opposed by medical associations and by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice for fear that it could have a chilling effect on appropriate opiate prescribing for legitimate chronic pain patients. And these fears are now coming true in our current ultra-conservative opiate prescribing environment. Well, let me review our history. In medical school in the 60s and 70s, doctors were taught never to use opiates for chronic pain. And as a result, pain was vastly undertreated in the U.S. by the 1980s. This precipitated a national crisis of pain undertreatment and led the U.S. Congress to proclaim the Decade of Pain Control and Research from 2001 through 2011. The opiate pendulum then swung from ultra-conservative to ultra-liberal in the 90s and 2000s. And as we all know, this precipitated the U.S. opiate crisis, which continues to evolve today. Over the past 5 years, the opiate pendulum has now swung back to the extreme conservative side, and many patients with legitimate need for opiates have been left in the lurch. And a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine sums up the current dilemma by documenting that legitimate chronic pain patients who are taken off opiates have a much higher incidence of ER visits, opioid-related hospitalizations, an increased incidence of mental health crises, more overdose events, and an increased risk of death from suicide or overdose. In a similar article outlining the intense suffering of chronic pain patients who have been cut off from opiate management, appeared in the New York Times as late as yesterday. The fact is that opiates are safe for the body's organs, even at high doses, for years. And many patients with severe chronic pain can take opiates without becoming addicted. And they do well when they have very few, if any, other good alternatives. Opiates certainly have risks, but these risks can be effectively managed. And the benefits of pain relief, improved function, and better quality of life can be provided to our patients with intractable pain through sensible opiate prescribing, which this bill promotes. Please bring the opiate pendulum back to the middle by passing HF 3786 so that doctors can effectively manage complex chronic pain patients using their medical judgment and expertise and the increased understanding of opiate risks and benefits that we have all gained over the past decade as we've watched the opioid crisis unfold. Thank you for letting me testify today.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Schultz. And I do want to note that Dr. Schultz, who just testified, is not related to Representative Schultz.
Right. We yes. spell it the same, though.
Yes. Yes, I see. Okay. Next, we have Dr. Todd Hess. Dr. Hess, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate it. And thank you, Madam Chairman, and the members for allowing me to speak, too. And on behalf of the Minnesota pain community, I couldn't be more proud to be next to David Schultz. David, I have 31 years now experience doing this also. And we all get along well in this state. That's what I've always loved about Minnesota. We come together and we do things right and well. And when we need to speak up, we do. I'm from a rural Minnesota. I'm a lifetime Minnesotan, trained at Mayo. I was chief resident. And I've now managed United Pain Center for 31 years. And again, I'm Dr. Todd Hess. And also, Beth, good to see you. It was nice to see you in San Francisco at a recent meeting. Your work is superb and wonderful for those of us on the ground. We have had the same experience, Beth, where we have started the voluntary, not forced. And I think we've done so much better. So kudos to you and fantastic work. So the downside of this, well, let's start upside first. You know, being from a farm, what worked well? Well, I agree with David. The CDC came out with this and we were terrified. And I believe we went from opiophobic to opiophilic and now back to opiophobic and terrified. What the CDC did right was it wiped out pill mills. Thank the Lord. David and I complained about this for years. How could we put some sensibility to this? In 2001, I started using controlled substance agreements well before legislation. We did pill counts, close follow-up, controlled substance agreements. We had case managers, social workers, psychologists on our staff. We had biofeedback and acupuncture. So we clearly in Minnesota saw that multimodal, just as Beth said, is the way to go. So there were good things with the CDC. There was also awareness, but there was unfortunate blame. We are not the cause of the opioid crisis, and we really see that. As opioids have legitimately dropped, overdoses and fentanyl overdoses have gone up skyrocketing. So I think we need to be sensible, just like Beth and Dave have said. The chilling effects have been extraordinary. And I guess with my, I'm an old man now. After 31 years of doing this, I've seen the whole pendulum, and I couldn't agree with David more, that we really need to be smart about this. For heaven's sake, cancer patients have been abandoned. Absolutely. And I'm sure David will tell you this. We hear this daily. Patients who have legitimate patient concerns as we go through the intractable pain diseases. So we talk about multiple sclerosis, CRPS, trigeminal neuralgia, lupus, rheumatoid, which I have, all sorts of other diseases, spinal cord injuries, arachnoiditis, you name it, multiple diseases causing severe pain. And physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs are now terrified to write. The letters we get from the DHS are certainly hard to look at. You know, it's like I went to Catholic school. It's like the Catholic nun pointing out your homework, even though you know you've done good work. It's looked punitive to us. Interestingly enough, the CDC guidelines were supposed to exclude pain doctors. And now in 30 states, it actually put us in the crossfire. In fact, I was told by a consultant, if I just got my MME down to 90, the target would be off my back. Now, I used to do target practice on the farm, but I never knew a doctor would have a target on his back for doing what's right for his patients. So that kind of language has gotten a little bit out of control. I'm also very proud of some wonderfully conservative medical groups who've come out very strongly in favor of the bill that Mr. Representative Bierman and I are talking about. such associations as the American Medical Association, as you've heard now multiple times, came out. The American Cancer Society, the Minnesota Medical Association just came out with a very good letter, I believe yesterday, supporting this and the need to have individualized care. The American Society of Anesthesiologists, of which I am. I'm double boarded in pain and anesthesia. The American Society of Hematology, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine, which has now been changed to ASRA Pain Medicine, which we just did in San Francisco recently, and then the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. So you can see that these are good, strong medical, we're not a bunch of crazies trying to say opioids are for everybody, because David and I and Beth know that's not true either. But they also do help some people, absolutely, and they do work. I believe the bill also helps a couple other things. I'm not sure why in Minnesota we'll make a pain patient go to two separate evaluations. That's been the latest thing we've been told. Dr. Soltz and I have 61 years now of combined knowledge. I think we can make the diagnosis of chronic intractable pain ourselves. If you notice, the Minnesota Medical Cannabis Program doesn't require two evaluations. Addiction specialists don't require two evaluations for their patients either. So why would we put the burden on a pain patient for opioids to go to two separate physicians or providers when that really seems unnecessary, duplicitous? And unfortunately for pain patients, that could be viewed as doctor shopping, which again could be a further bias, as Beth knows happens. There's a lot of shame in the pain world just because of how opioids are perceived. Also, the pharmacy benefit managers, I have pharmacists calling me and telling me not, they won't fill my scripts. I'm not sure when or how that got started. I'm an MD. My patients go through the controlled substance agreement. We do an assessment, a addiction assessment risk. And so for pushback like that, it just does not seem fair to those of us who follow all the rules. And for our patients who follow all the rules, it is yet another burden. So as you can see, we can do better, Minnesota. We've done great things. We've lowered unnecessary prescriptions. We've worked very well together. I strongly support HF 3786 to rectify the wrongs, to actually do what's right, and make sure that if you or your family ever have to see David or I, we're happy to see the most difficult cases, but we need to be able to have the freedom to do what is right. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hess. Appreciate you being here. And our final testifier is Ray Blaylark. And then I hope we'll have some time for a couple of questions here because I see some members have their hands up. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ray Blaylark. I am the president and CEO of Sickle Cell Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the other members of the committee. I'm here representing human beings born into pain, not by choice, but by circumstance. One of those human beings is my very own 25-year-old son, who not only has sickle cell disease, but he also has a degenerative spinal condition. The remaining hundreds of patients across our state are my surrogate children and my surrogate family members that I am representing. As a mother and a caregiver to so many, I'm glaringly aware that sickle cell disease primarily, but not exclusively, affects Black and brown human beings. For several years, I was an employee of Children's Minnesota and a part of the sickle cell medical team caring for more than 90% of our kids with sickle cell disease across Minnesota. I've experienced the suffering of people with sickle cell disease and their loved ones who have nowhere left to turn to relieve the suffering and the resulting pain anxiety, as we call it, and the pain PTSD that occurs over time. I see the decline in the quality of life because of untreated, mistreated, undertreated pain. I see the helplessness that turns into hopelessness. I see the suicide. I have a very close friend that when I was very young in this journey, committed suicide because of the pain. I hear the stories of suicidal ideation. I hear and watch the mental health crises from individuals who were born into such excruciating pain. We talk about intractable pain. We talk about chronic pain. We talk about acute pain. I would make the argument that sometimes that language becomes a barrier for people in the community who may use those terms interchangeably because they don't necessarily understand those differences and how the use of those terms in the wrong setting may in fact actually lend to why they may not get access to the medications that they need. But more importantly, we want to recognize that intractable pain, that definition clearly encompasses a disease that was identified in 1910. It was the first identified genetic condition, and yet it still does not have a cure. It still has not relieved the pain. And because of the pendulum that was discussed, it has swung in so many directions. It's important to recognize that needing a second opinion disregards the ever-growing shortage of sickle cell disease experts in the medical field and in medical school because of the fears of going into this particular specialty and not having the support or not being able to practice the medicine that you committed your life to be able to execute. Although the American Society of Hematology is seeking to improve this and the misapplication of opioid prescribing guidelines, we must move to right the wrongs of previous guidance, application, and early legislation based on that misapplication. In addition, the second evaluation adds to the stigma of the disease itself. As was said, the stigma of doctor shopping, the stigma that ultimately increases medical bias by non-sickle cell disease experts. And so it is very important that we really address this from an equitable way, but also a medically appropriate way that allows our physicians, allows experts to do their jobs. Sickle cell disease patients are regularly denied access to palliative care services. So we have to be careful that it's not just about palliative care, but the reality is that this is a condition whose complications do cause early death. And it's a slow, very painful death, but it is a terminal illness nonetheless. While the data is clear that individuals living with sickle cell disease being treated with opioids are actually less likely to experience drug addiction and overdose. That data has not been widely shared, or it's being disregarded by many physicians. So in addition to the pain management guidelines made in 2020, we are hopeful that HF 3786 will protect medical providers by allowing them to provide their sickle cell expertise in a way that considers without bias the humane treatment and improved quality of life for individuals living with sickle cell disease. It's our
sense. Ms. Blaylock, I have to ask you to wrap it up. Sorry.
No problem.
Finish up.
No, so we appreciate that this bill is being heard, and we appreciate the work that has gone into it. And we are here to support doing the right thing for patients and providers. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and thank you to the testifiers. They did an excellent job. I wanted to thank Representative Bierman and Representative Baker for bringing this forward. I have a brother-in-law who has severe nerve pain, and he was on opioids until we passed the last bill. And then his doctor quit prescribing him and said, I don't want to deal with it. So he had to go find a different doctor, and he had just enough to help him to be able to function. The other doctor put him on something else, but it didn't work very good, and he was miserable constantly. So I do think this is a good modification, and I just want to thank the representatives for bringing it forward, and especially the testifiers, if we can help in any way with people with severe intractable pain. Last point, Representative Bierman, I won't ask your question, but the little bit of criticism I did hear is that the bill is maybe a little over-prescriptive in terms of what is actual intractable pain. So I just ask you to look at that and see if it can be modified in a way that doctors can do what's actually necessary for the patient. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like to echo my thanks for Representative Bierman and bringing this forward. As representatives, we choose a few things we want to work on, and then some things get thrown at us. And like you, I was contacted by some patients that were really suffering by being restricted on this. And I've spent a lot of late nights talking to people about this who were very depressed. And I'm glad this is moving forward and excited to be a co-sponsor on this bill. It's a good bill. And I think government sometimes does swing too far in the other direction. I know we have an opioid issue, and we can do the only thing we can do, which is control the legal opioids and not the illegal opioids. And I hope that this gets through and signed into law. It's a good bill. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Munson. Other questions or comments? So I would just say, I guess, and maybe others will have something else they want to say as well, but when I heard that Representative Bierman was working on this, I was thrilled, because I have long felt that certainly I was an early critic of the PMP, and I still am. It's had tremendous mission creep over the years, but even the basic premise, it was, I think, pretty clear that people who were cut off by their doctors were going to go to the street to get their drugs, and that, unfortunately, we've seen that. But I also think that as a general matter, when legislatures, which, by our nature, we are a political body, we are not an expertise body. And when we start to tell practitioners how they should practice, it is very easy to get into trouble. And, not to say that we shouldn't look at the policy aspects of this, because I think Representative Munson said it very well. There are perhaps things that we needed to do, but I think we need to, maybe it's a lesson for us for the future that we should do these things with a great deal of humility, because we do not have the expertise. We do not have the patient in front of us. And we are not the ones who should be making individual decisions. And policy is a broad brush. So I'm so really grateful to all of the testifiers, and to especially to Representative Bierman, Representative Baker, for working on this. And I know that it does, it has a little ways to go yet, as I understand. I mean, I think Representative Bierman said it's not completely finished, that there a little more work needs to be done on the bill. So are there other questions from members or others who want to comment? Okay, we rushed our testifiers a little bit because I was afraid that we were going to run out of time, because we were going to have so much discussion here. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I agree with everything you said. And it's why we need to get rid of networks and pre-certification and everything else, and free up the doctors to actually treat people within certain parameters. And single payer is not going to do that. It's going to bring a micromanagement of the doctor-patient relationship by legislators and politicians. We don't need that. Anyway.
Representative Grunhagen, we're on Representative Bierman's bill on intractable pain and prescribing of opioids, but okay, yeah. The tape has run. So,
I did agree with your a lot of
okay.
your
okay. All right. Okay, Representative Baker.
Just real quick, Madam Chair. I guess I just want to, in closing, thank Representative Bierman for handling this bill. It's a complicated bill, and again, I agree again with everything that you said too, that I always knew that walking this angle of getting into prescribing decisions was not what legislators should be doing. I know that I've said that many times in front of your committee, Madam Chair and others. I make no apologies for what we had to do for a while to start getting their attention. However, we needed to say enough already. And again, today's my son's anniversary of passing away. Exactly 11 years today at 5:30, in about 1 hour, I will have gotten that call. And so this is a big day, and it happens to be the day that Rep. Bierman is in this committee talking about this, and I got to kind of work with him on this, and I'm honored to do that. So Legislators, we have a role to play in helping policy to not get in the way. And we need to move quickly. And I think for this case, it hasn't been quick enough for some of the patients that are in intractable pain. We got to do something now. And I think we've been pretty nimble on this, passing just a big, big bill a couple years ago. And now we got to get this thing right. So, Representative Bierman, nice job, and keep working on this thing. I'll be right alongside you as much as you want me to be. And this is where we are today, but we learned a great deal, and I hope this never, ever happens again with our pain patients. So thank you again, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Representative Baker, and our condolences. It's always, I'm sure, that the day gets no easier when it comes around every year. But you have certainly honored your son's memory, no question about it, with your work on this issue. And thank you for all that you've done. And other comments, Representative Bierman, do you want to wrap it up?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just first and foremost to my colleague, Rep. Baker, thank you so much. And thank you for acknowledging the date and sharing that with us, all of us here today. It's very touching. And we just appreciate the work you have done in this space and what you have taught me as we've moved along in this process. There hasn't been a doctor or a legislator or a patient that I've spoken to over the course of this time that hasn't taught me a lot about the issue, how complex it is, and coming to a point where we still face, record numbers of deaths from opioids, from fentanyl, and from the streets. And I talked to the police about this issue. It's a growing problem. But in this space, we've tried to work just very narrowly to just help, number one, as has been mentioned, letting medical doctors do their work, number one, and then ensuring that intractable and chronic pain patients can receive the care that they need. And it's also about ensuring support for addiction treatment and keeping legislators and bureaucracy from making medical decisions. So we heard that time and again today, and I just appreciate members' participation and interest and willingness to keep moving on this issue as it moves forward, because passing the bill is nothing if we don't implement it and make sure that it's working and then get to the other side of this fentanyl issue, which, we all have to also focus like a laser on that, because that is a health problem that is getting worse, not better. So thank you, members, for listening. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate taking
the time. And thank you so much, Representative Bierman. And, I can't help but also note that we haven't really heard anything today about the role of the drug companies, which we now know was extreme in promoting these drugs and downplaying the harms. And that's why we have these lawsuits and so on. And so I know we all kind of stand here today wishing that we'd had 2020 hindsight in so many ways, right? But we also have to recognize that we all operate within the sphere of what information comes to us. And the only thing we can do is try to go forward and do better. And, I'm sure that much of our medical community feels that way about, having been, promoted or having these drugs promoted to them as much safer than they really were in addition. So, okay, well, I really thank all of the testifiers for being here and sharing your experience and wisdom with us. It was a very moving, very valuable hearing. And thank you to Representative Bierman again for all of your work on this and for your continued work. And I hope that we're going to get to a place where we're going to be able to move this forward and make some real improvement this session. And with that, House File 3786, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So, members, we will be meeting again next week, of course, on our regular schedule. We will be posting the schedule for next week very shortly. And thank you for all of your attention this afternoon. And with that, we stand adjourned.